This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Tonight we bring back our regular panel. George is with us.
Hi, everybody.
And James.
Hello.
And Niall.
Hello.
Tom decided to take the night off. Tonight we're joined with a guest who has done some work on the topic of ex-Mormon exit narratives. Seth Payne is a lifelong member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He graduated from Brigham Young University, cum laude, with a BS in management. And also he graduated with his MA, summa cum laude, in religion from Yale. At Yale, Seth pursued his interest in both Mormon studies and practical and political ethics. Seth currently works for the New York Stock Exchange as a technical consultant and is working on his MBA in finance and strategy from New York University. Seth currently resides on Manhattan's Upper West Side. Seth, welcome to Mormon Expression.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, one of the reasons we brought you on is you've done some interesting work on the topic of ex-Mormon narratives. Maybe you can start us off by explaining what you mean by an ex-Mormon narrative.
Sure. So I'll give you a little background on how I got started on this topic. What I had done is at Yale, I had a great academic advisor who let me have a lot of freedom in the types of things that I was studying. And I did a project on what I called Orthodox history. And so I kind of compared the difference between what was being taught in official church channels through the Institute of Seminary programs and to what we could consider the new Mormon history to see what differences there were and to kind of comment on that. So that was an interesting project. And as part of that, what piqued my interest was I had noticed that a lot of ex-Mormons on the internet were expressed historical concerns as the genesis for them leaving the faith or them losing their faith. And so my initial intent was to capture and validate this fact. So I was basically trying to argue that by the church being putting such a positive spin on every aspect of its history, it was actually having the opposite effect of building faith. It was in a lot of cases destroying faith. And so I was trying to kind of quantify that effect. The problem was, as I was talking with Richard Bushman and Armin Moss, who were very helpful in the project, Armin put me on to some literature about narratives and about how when we recall events and we tell stories, especially as it involves coming into organizations, religious organizations, and leaving those organizations, as a researcher, it's very difficult to have someone recall and tell you the reasons why they left an organization and to be able to use that in a strictly scientific manner. So if I were trying to prove, for example, that Mike Quinn's work on the Mormon hierarchy led to a certain number of people leaving the church, I would actually have to do a much more extensive study, take a random group, track them over a long period of time, and see what impact, if they happen to run across this material, all those types of things. So that would be quite an extensive study. And so Armin, he encouraged me to look into these narratives because he said they are valuable. He said you can learn a lot from them, but you can't necessarily rely on them for giving an accurate picture of the reasons why someone left or the reasons why certain events occurred. And it doesn't just have to do with religion. This is a general sociological phenomenon. We tend to, as we look back at our lives and try and kind of figure out all these events that have happened in our lives, we all create a narrative, even if it's an internal narrative, about why we've done certain things, what we've learned through those experiences, those types of things. So they're very important sociologically, and we can learn a lot from narratives, but as far as trying to establish actual occurrence or coming up with a definitive list of historical documents which led people to lose their faith, that's a much more difficult thing to establish when you look at someone recalling their own experience and essentially giving you a narrative. And so as I looked into this, what I found was a pattern emerging in these ex-Mormon narratives as people were talking about leaving the church, the reasons why they left the church, how they left the church, how difficult to leave the church. I noticed a real close alignment between what the sociological literature had to say about exit narratives and the ex-Mormon narrative. There were a lot of parallels, a lot of things that you would say, well, yes, that fits in perfectly, and of course, a lot of elements which were different from what the sociological literature had to say about what it calls exit narratives or apostate narratives. And what I found really interesting is that the church is such a unique organization in that it's very difficult to pinpoint how society views it, because different societal segments view the church so differently. A lot of people see it as this great allegiant, what would we call an allegiant organization, which provides a lot of social capital. Those type of organizations produce defectors. And then you have contestant organizations, which are more like you could think of a business as a contestant organization. So it's still respected in the community generally, but there is some skepticism of its motives because it is a self-interested organization. Certainly Mormonism is seen that way because of our missionary efforts and other things. And then, of course, there's the subversive organization, which many people view the church as subversive, being, you know, producing negative social capital, being destructive for society. And so you can see all those elements come into play there. And so what happens is people who leave the church or any organization, they tend to create a story about why they were part of that organization and then how they left. And those stories have common elements depending on whether they were a defector for an organization, whether they were a contestant, or whether it was a subversive organization. So that's what I that's kind of what got me started down the track of looking into these.
Okay, so where out there do you find these things?
Well, my initial project and what I've written, most of them came from exmormon.org. Were I to start over and do this project again, I have since found many, many more narratives at different places, which have a little different tone than the ones at exmormon.org, which I found, but do seem to have show the same similar structure and pattern as the ones there. And then just to come, I also looked at narratives produced by members of counter-cult organizations like Concerned Christians, which is, you know, determined to save Mormons and show them the real Jesus. And, you know, Saints Alive with Ed Decker's group, Bill Schneblin's group with One Accord Ministries, those types of organizations. So those were the two main groups that I looked at.
Yeah, Seth, I have a question for you. You mentioned the fact that a lot of this is based on previous sociological work and studies in other types of organizations.
Yeah.
Before we go down into the church's side, could you give a quick backgrounder on where those studies come from, what kind of organizations they studied? I'm a little bit fascinated to find out if this is all directed at religious organizations or if it's exit strategies for lots of different types of groups.
Sure. It covers a broad range of groups. And so David Bromley is the main researcher here. He's written a couple of different articles, and he is the one that proposed this typology of allegiant, contestant, and subversive organizations. And so he studied a wide range of groups. So Allegiant organizations, he talks about hospitals and charitable organizations. Contestant, he's talking about businesses. And then Subversive, he's actually done extensive study on counter-cult movements, especially I think a lot of it was done in the late 70s, you know, with counter-cult movements against the Moonies and those types of groups. So his research does apply to a broad range of organizations, but he has spent a lot of time looking at apostates and apostasy in general to see what happens when people choose to leave either these very subversive organizations, which are which you know produce these very kind of aggressive anti exit narratives, or whether it's from contestant or Allegiant organizations. Interestingly, all of them create stories, right? When you leave one of these organizations, you there are stories created, narratives created, and Bromley has spent a lot of time studying all of those.
Now, Seth, when you're talking about counter-cult organizations, from the Mormon perspective, those are mostly evangelical in nature, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So when I talk about and generally in the sociological literature, when you talk counter-cult, you're talking about these evangelical organizations, or there are a few secular ones who are trying to get loved ones or trying to get other people out of other types of non-Christian groups that show cult-like properties or that are cult-like. But yeah, mostly when I talk about counter-cult, especially in regard to Mormonism, it's going to be these fervent anti, what we would traditionally call anti-Mormon evangelical Christian ministries.
Now, you mentioned in your original research that you looked at both the exmormon.org and then some evangelical narratives. Now, exmormon.org is probably pretty militantly secularist. Did you see any difference between the two sets of narratives?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The biggest difference, and I really wasn't surprised by this, the biggest difference between the two sets of narratives were that the evangelical narratives were much more likely to introduce blatant fabrication. So, for example, being a member of the church all my life, having gone to the temple and being fairly familiar with temple practices and the like, you know, in the evangelical exit narratives, you would hear descriptions of things, and immediately someone familiar with the church could say, well, that's just absurd. That's not how a temple recommend is issued, or someone of that age would not be getting their endowments, or, you know, something of that nature. So I saw none of that happen in the exmormon.org narratives or the secular narratives. It only occurred in the evangelical ones. And I don't have any, you know, proof of this, but my theory is that the evangelical narratives are written, they're driven very much to meet the needs of the host organization. So you have a group like Concerned Christians, you have a group like Saints Alive. And so the narratives are trying to serve that overarching organizational purpose. And so they're going to be more likely to introduce anything that makes Mormonism appear nefarious. Whereas exmormon.org, it's a loose coalition. It's what Bromley would call an oppositional coalition, but it has nowhere near the organizational drive that an evangelical organization would have. So that's the biggest difference. Other than that, obviously, evangelicals are going to say, yes, I've come out of Mormonism and become, you know, a Bible-believing Christian. Most of the narratives at exmormon.org, people tended to go towards more of a secular route, or more of what I would call a liberal Christian route, at least is what's being reported. So that's an obvious difference. But as far as structure and basic issues that were touched upon, they were very similar.
Seth, first off, thank you for doing this research. I find it that it confirms a lot of you know my experiences when in confronting the evangelical narrative, you know, factory of almost blatant, you know, lies. And also, I have a question dealing with Mormons when comparing it to other exit narratives from the Moonies or other similar organizations. How do they compare? How does a Mormon, you know, an ex-Mormon narrative compare to an ex-Moonie narrative? Are there similarities? Do you find anything that, you know, kind of stands out to you as being, you know, very similar or even dissimilar?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I found that was most striking to me was this notion of a captivity narrative. And this is something that Bromley discusses at length when he's talking about exiting from subversive organizations. So what a captivity narrative is essentially a story of a person who joined a particular group. They felt like it was a normal, functioning, healthy group, and only after a certain amount of time did they begin to realize that the group was actually quite dangerous. They went through a period of realization and then painful separation, and now they feel it's their responsibility to expose the true intention of the group. So they were captive at one point, held kind of by these very strict cultural rules. Well, in the case of Mormonism, right, it's not a strict captivity. The Mormonism doesn't exert, you know, the same type of influence as, say, the Branch Davidians would, at least directly. But there is a lot of cultural influence that goes into keeping people Mormon and influencing their decision to stay believing members of the church. There's a lot of pressure that way. And so the captive, as described by ex-Mormons, kind of frames it in those terms. I was being held captive by these strong family pressures, by this teaching all my life that this was the one and only true church. It was, and of course, all of this makes it very difficult for the person to finally leave. And then another part of that is that when the person does decide to leave, it becomes a very difficult process because other members in the group are saying, "How can you leave us? We've got the truth. You're going to be very unhappy once you're gone. Your life's going to fall apart." All of these things. And then, of course, the captivity narrative is capped off by a testimony of sorts saying how much better life is now that this person is away from the group. So that is something that was common amongst both the ex-Mormon narratives, although it's not as I'm not quite sure the word to use. It's not as strident. It's not as aggressive. Any ex-Mormon narratives, as say it would be for something – the Moonies are more mainstream than they used to be, but maybe back in the 70s when some of their tactics were a little more aggressive, you would get a lot stronger language about the social control exerted. But certainly if we were to read an exit narrative of someone who left the FLDS church, for example, or some other type of group which is very isolated, you would get a similar structure, but it would be framed a little differently simply because the organization, the host organization, exerts its control in a different way.
So that raises an interesting question. You know, when you're talking about the Moonies or the Branch Davidians, I would assume most of the people giving those sort of captive narratives are converts. I don't think somebody born into a religious tradition would ever view themselves as a captive. So did you see any difference between convert ex-Mormon narratives and those who were born in the church?
Converts tended to give an explanation that or explain that when they joined the church, they were vulnerable. So it was just following a divorce, a nasty breakup with a boyfriend or girlfriend. They had moved to a new city and were alone and were befriended by local Mormons and that's how they got involved. So that was very unique to converts. Although the similarity is that, and I write about this is my I provide a general structure, but what I title this is the apology, right? In all of these narratives, there is some sort of explanation as to why the person was once a believing Mormon. Now, whether this was someone who was born in the church or whether they were a convert. Now, converts express this by saying, I was vulnerable, that's why I joined. Born in the church members would express it in different ways, but that element seemed to be very, very common and present in nearly all of the narratives. People were giving an apology of sorts to say, yeah, that's why I believed that silly stuff back then, and now I no longer believe that. So that was a very common element and similar between both converts and born in church.
And that would certainly fit directly with, you know, what the missionaries have been instructed to do, which is to find, you know, emotionally vulnerable and just to convert. And so that would fit directly with, you know, what in has been my experience in the mission field, which is find somebody who is malleable and, I guess, quote unquote, teachable, who is, you know, going through, like you said, going through a divorce, you know, recently moved to an area and doesn't know anyone. Maybe they're, you know, just lost their job. Find somebody who's emotionally vulnerable and exploit them.
Yeah, I mean, that's I would hope to think that missionaries aren't thinking in terms of exploitation, but I know when I was a missionary, obviously it was a lot easier to go into poorer areas to knock on doors than it was into wealthy areas, and definitely easier to teach people who had just gone through some and of course I think as a missionary most are thinking, I'm here to help this person. I'm here to give them the gospel when they most need it. But a lot of these people who join under those circumstances, in retrospect, seem to indicate that, well, the only reason I joined was because I was vulnerable. So yeah, it is an interesting dynamic.
But is it fair to really take the tack of doing that when they're actually exiting? If you asked them if they were vulnerable when they were strong in the church and maybe right, just a year after baptism, I doubt if you'd hear most of these people say they were found at a vulnerable time in their lives.
That's a very good point, and that's a question I don't know if I could answer with a degree of confidence, because, you know, if you listen to testimony meeting, right, how many people say that at the point they were given the gospel, they were at a low point in their life, they had given up hope, you know, they were, but this is an opportunity to point out something very, very fascinating, is that basically exit narratives, whether it's from Mormonism or anything else, it mirrors the testimony coming in, right? So the testimony coming in is going to be the same as the testimony going out. And this is very common, and it's not surprising. And so basically if you imagine a Mormon, ex-Mormon narrative, it's testimony meeting in reverse. The same elements come into play. It's just that they're given a different spin.
Well, Seth, that brings up one of the chief questions I had when reading through your work here. I wondered how much of this is just a artifact of the Mormon culture, that the narrative is a very integral part of Mormonism in terms of testimony meeting. And, you know, when going out to serve on a mission, you're taught to rely on your own experience. Is this just that continuing?
You know, it's part of it. But it's not, yes. I mean, so you're right. It is a continuation of that, but it's not just isolated to Mormonism. These narratives are produced under every circumstance, every religious organization, non-religious organizations. You know, you listen to Amway people who go in, you know, I was lost. I didn't know what to do until I had Amway. And then, of course, they become disillusioned. And, you know, what was I thinking joining that Amway scam? And I'm out now. And so you see it happen all the time, this mirror between entry and exit. Those that enter talk about all the reasons they came out, and then those are the same reasons, just in reverse, when they. So it is a now Mormonism is unique in that way, because and I think this is a sign of Mormonism's unique societal positioning, in that we are a people that require people that require stories to be told, right? So when you join the church, you're expected to bear your testimony, right? This is kind of an informal way of saying, I'm part of the group now. This is what you do. When you're a Mormon, you get up and bear your testimony about how you know these things are true. And that's very common amongst groups that are kind of on the – well, mainline churches don't do that, right? You don't go to a Catholic meeting and have a Catholic testimony meeting. You don't have – a Lutheran testimony meeting. So I think it's a sign of Mormonism's kind of marginal positioning, that is such an essential part of a culture. And of course, but you know, and I should point out, you also don't get a whole lot of Catholic exit narratives these days. You just get people kind of bowing out. So again, that's a sign of, I think, of Mormonism's unique societal positioning, that you have that the group requires, and I'm using that word very loosely here. I mean, it's a cultural kind of expectation that you produce this testimony coming in. But also, if you're going to become a very active part of the post-Mormon community or the ex-Mormon community, what's one of the first things you do when you come in? You tell the story of how you left and how you became disillusioned, right? So this also is not uncommon. So Bromley would call exmormon.org or the Ex-Mormon Foundation or Post-Mormon. He would call these oppositional coalitions, less so for Post-Mormon than Ex-Mormon Foundation. And he explains that it's very common that people create narratives when they want to gain entry to these new social groups. So if I want to become part of the Ex-Mormon Foundation or part of this virtual community online, part of that is going to be to share my experience of coming out of Mormonism.
So I mean, basically the sharing of that narrative becomes almost a social currency.
You know, in a sense it does. It's, again, I'm speaking, these are very loose sociological kind of constructs here. So it's not as if you can't engage in the ex-Mormon community or even in the Mormon community without producing a narrative. But it seems that producing the narrative is part of this normative process into becoming part of the community. And I think in a lot of sense, you know, I think it's a natural process for people trying to understand their new feelings about religion, their new feelings about church, coming in or leaving the church. They're making a big change. And so the formation of this story helps them kind of put in perspective where they are and helps them gather their feelings. So I think the narrative creation process is very healthy, and I think that it's I think that also plays a role, is that people are trying to get a perspective on their own transition.
Hey Seth, talk a little bit about the transition of a narrative. I imagine as most people travel through this journey, the narrative portion will change. How much do you see that being an effect on some of this as well? Is that there'll be narrative version number one, and then version two, and then version three?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the limitations of my research is that I only studied iteration one, right? So I'm reading narratives that seem to be right when people are coming out of the church. And in the few years now that I have continued to study this, I have seen these second iterations and third iterations coming about, although I don't have any data to support it. So anything I offer here would be totally anecdotal. So I do think there is a change, because generally when people – it seems that when they're coming out, that's when they're the most hurt, they're the most angry, they're the most frustrated, and the narrative is an expression of that. And then through time, people do seem to come to terms with their new beliefs. I think I listened to the podcast you did with John DeLynn. He described something similar. He went through a process of real disillusionment and then kind of came to terms with it and found a new faith that he was comfortable with. And he happened to end up, you know, staying with the church and being involved in the ways that he wants to be involved. But I think a lot of people go through that. And over time, I think the narratives would soften in their tone, and it would be less. I'm not sure how to explain it, but it would definitely soften, would be my guess, although I haven't studied this in depth, but this has generally been my impression.
Hey, I'm curious. We have two ex-Mormons on the panel, James and Niall. James and Niall, did either of you write one of these narratives?
Yeah, but, you know, to be quite honest, that I wrote several narratives, and, you know, along with what we've been discussing, it did change over time. If I were to sit down and write one these days, there'd be a lot less anger, a lot less vitriol, and, you know, a lot more introspection on how I came to the decision instead of kind of just vomiting up, you know, what, you know, specific disagreement with the church.
So did you post yours online, James?
No.
What about you, Niall?
I guess mentally I had a narrative, and those who were closest to me would sort of get chapters and developments of it. But I've never committed it to writing or sort of taken a snapshot of it. So I guess, in a way, I would still fit into the pattern, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Now, Seth, in your work, you talked about some of the patterns, the kind of formulas that are exhibited.
Yes.
What are some of those formulaic elements that show up in all these narratives?
Yeah, I'll go over that. But first, I definitely want to point out, you know, the potential weaknesses of my studies, because when I did this, I focused very much on exmormon.org, which, and I wasn't aware at the time or hadn't been exposed to places like the foyer.org and other places, which have a much different tone to them. And so what I'm presenting, while I still am very, very confident in the overall structure, we can't take the specific percentages that I come up with here and extrapolate them out to apply to all ex-Mormon narratives. The percentages were merely placed to help me see patterns in what I had read. And so I did. I think it was a year ago. Mike Ash emailed me about ex-Mormonism and people leaving. He's like, "Do we have any hard numbers on people leaving and those types of things?" And I was sure to reiterate that to him that we have to be careful about extrapolating things out. So, you know, what I'm basically trying to say is that what I present here is just a general idea of patterns, and one which may or may not exist in ex-Mormon narratives, but is something that I've consistently seen. So, having said that, what I found was that they generally start out with an introduction to establish credibility, and this was done in a number of ways. It was stated that I went on a mission. I went to all 4 years of seminary. I attended this number of years of institute. I graduated from BYU. I come from pioneer ancestry. I was a bishop. There was a couple of them where people were bishops, temple workers, Relief Society presidents. So it seemed to be that there was this initial effort to kind of establish credibility, that what I'm about to tell you is genuine because I was really Mormon. I was fully into it, and so I know what I'm talking about. So that was one of the first things that I noticed. And then that tended to transition into what I call the apology, and I mentioned that before, or a statement about how the person became disenfranchised with the church and kind of detached from the church. And these had, you know, there wasn't as much consistency in this section, but a lot of people explained that they never really had a testimony. As I mentioned before, they may have been vulnerable at the time of conversion. They had long-term doubts, you know, 10, 20 years that they kind of just held inside before they finally couldn't take it anymore. They had difficulty with other church members and hypocrisy. They were never comfortable with the one true church attitude. A lot of people mentioned that they found that their first temple experience very unsettling. So a lot of these things were present in this apology or this statement of, yeah, I've established my credibility. I was fully Mormon, but at the same time, I never quite felt quite like I fit in, right? So, you know, maybe someone was gay, maybe someone was a feminist, an intellectual. A lot of those elements kind of showed up there in this statement of disenfranchisement.
What I find interesting about that is that basically they're using the same format of establishing credibility as you would if you would have met another Mormon while still Mormon. You know, I went on a mission. You know, I've held these specific callings. You know, I pioneer stock, et cetera.
Exactly. And these are cultural things that we do in Mormonism to kind of communicate to each other how serious we are about Mormonism. Right. So I was an Elders Quorum president. I went on a mission. You know, you're absolutely right. We do these things all the time to let other people know where we stand with the church and with our beliefs. So you're right on.
On a similar note, I noticed that, you know, in the church, there's a lot of deference to authority. And the higher rank you were on the ex-Mormon narrative, the more popular the narrative seemed to be.
Right. You know, there's one in particular, I don't know the name. There's a gentleman on exmormon.org who describes that he received the second anointing. And I know he is very popular or was at one time and told some very interesting stories. I'm not sure if he was a stake president or not. I believe so on a couple of bishops, but I think you're right. The higher the calling, the more attention it received. At least in the community. And interestingly, though, there were very, very few narratives from people who did hold high callings. So like I mentioned, out of, you know, the 150 or so narratives I looked at, two of them said they were bishops, two of them said they were Relief Society presidents, and one of those was a Relief Society president when she was in a singles ward. So it was not common that a stake president or a mission president or someone would make that statement. So does that mean that less mission presidents, less stake presidents, less bishops are coming out? That's possible. It could also mean that less of them create narratives, or maybe when you're in that high position, you have so much invested that you don't, and you do have doubts that you just kind of keep them hidden. I've received at least a couple of emails from members of stake presidencies who wanted to remain anonymous, but had asked me different questions after seeing me post on different locations and shared with me that they were in the stake presidency and had doubts and were struggling and really didn't believe anymore and what, you know, weren't quite sure how to move forward. So, you know, I think that's an interesting thing that could be really studied further is at, you know, at some point you're so into the Mormon culture that, you know, do you ever really get to a point where you feel comfortable coming out? And I think absolutely that's an open question, but an interesting question.
It might also be a statistical fragment. If you sampled 150 Mormons, you'd only expect one, two, or three to be bishops or stake presidents also.
You know, that is quite true. That is quite true. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that is a question for further study. And one I would be very interested in finding the answer to. It'd be very difficult to get that data, but fascinating nonetheless. So
it seems like the thing that they usually pound into you when you're studying sociology or anthropology or anything like that is the one thing you're really not supposed to do is sort of study your own culture, your own paradigm. How did you get around the problems associated with that?
Yeah, so that was difficult. I mean, I'm essentially you know, I'm a proud Mormon, but a non-believing Mormon, and was at the time that I undertook this study. So, and I think that was part of the reason I looked into it is because I could relate to a lot of these narratives and a lot of the feelings that were being expressed and a lot of the frustration and things like that. So in order to get around that, I really tried to limit my conclusions and be very, very narrow in any type of strong conclusion I could draw. I was very faithful to the sociological literature on the matter. I did have Armin Moss look at a few things for me, and I passed, you know, had him look at a few questions for me. Of course, he's LDS as well, but he's a great sociologist, a renowned sociologist. So I was cognizant of that and did try to avoid that. But I think that the biggest thing was is that I really tried to be very conservative in any type of conclusions that I've drawn. And indeed, my research does not – it doesn't really provide a lot of conclusions. Probably the strongest thing I can conclude is this very loose structure of the narrative. And also I'm currently working on a pastoral pastoral theology paper involving ex-Mormonism, and I think that the narratives themselves can really provide some insight into the struggles that people go through in a conservative religious tradition. So again, just to reiterate, I tried to really keep my conclusions low key and also just kind of maintain a healthy skepticism about what I was reading and be very cognizant of what I was maybe reading into things. But yeah, that's a great question because it's a very difficult thing to avoid.
Do you ever consider that perhaps that reticence to draw firm conclusions could be a problem?
It could be, but my biggest problem in me drawing strong conclusions is just simply the manner in which I collected data and the nature of the data that I collected. In order to draw a conclusion about ex-Mormon narratives and extrapolate that, I would have had to have studied many, many more narratives, randomly sampled people, done things that basically at the time I didn't have resources to do. So I think that it's more a function of the structure of the study that I did. And I point this out in my writing that this should be considered preliminary or pilot. It should give us some ideas. It should raise more questions than produce conclusions. And I think that's what it did. So if I had the funds and the time to explore some of these very fascinating questions that it raised, I mean, it would be a great opportunity. But I mean, you do make a good point. I mean, that was some criticism that I received from my academic advisor when I turned this in. He said, look, this is fascinating, but you know, your conclusion is like, I'm not sure what you're concluding here. When I presented this at Sunstone, I focused more on the pastoral aspects and expanded on that as being more of my conclusion. And that is this, that what I walked away from this experience with is that these narratives expressed things that were very painful for people. And people went through very difficult times transitioning out of the church. And people oftentimes had a very difficult time in the church. And so what I took away from that was that, you know, the church works really well for people that fit. People who are straight and married and have kids and you know, who fit into the system. A woman who gets married, you know, in her 20s and all that, you know, a single woman who's over 30 and in her 40s and even a man who's single, I mean, where do they fit within the church? So what I walked away from this experience is that there are people in the church that hurt. They feel as if they don't fit and they want to fit. There are people who are leaving the church that are very, you know, treated very poorly on their way out. And I think from a pastoral theology perspective, there are things that we can do in the church to rectify these problems. So if nothing else, the narratives demonstrated that these problems do exist. And that has been confirmed with some of my one-on-one correspondence and meetings with ex-Mormons, that this is a painful process, and this is a very real process. I think too often, you know, members of the church come up with excuses of why people leave, and they say, well, oh, it's because they were offended, or, you know, they didn't have a strong testimony, or they wanted to break the commandments, or whatever. And, you know, that from my experience, both in the study and in looking at the ex-Mormon community talking with people in it, that's generally not the case at all. People want to stay. They love the church. They love they enjoy at least some aspects of being part of that, and it's really painful to draw away from that. So I think that as Mormons, there's a lot we can do to one, if people want to stay, help them find a way to do it. And I think John DeLynn's doing a great job with that. And two, if people don't want to stay, if they decide that it's not a culture that is going to work for them, let's be Christ-like about how we help them out of that. Let's not put them on this major guilt trip and make them feel make a very painful process even more painful for them. And so I think there's a lot we can learn from that.
Seth, the conclusions you had about evangelical versus secular narratives, how much visibility do you think that the mainline LDS believing Mormon has? Do you think that the evangelical narrative is more visible to them, or the secular? If someone were to ask me that, I would say that the evangelical narrative is more along the lines of the ideal, basically of what the typical exit story is. You know, this very in not only just the straight content of an evangelical exit narrative, but the spirit of you know what you're describing in the evangelical narrative of being mean-spirited, you know, child molestation in the temple kind of things.
Right,
you know?
Right. Sure. No, that's a great question. I think you're right on that. Mormons know how to handle that type of story, right? They know that this story's been coming at us since the beginning, since Mormonism unveiled, right? I mean, I was just reading that the other day, the introduction of that. And again, it's an attack on how Mormonism is unchristian and it's a fraud based on, you know, its pretense to biblical, you know, truth, whatever. So this is an attack which I think most Mormons are just used to, and they've heard it 100 times, and they'll continue to hear it, and it's very easy to just kind of ignore. And the secular attack or the secular exit narrative, I should refrain that. Not all these narratives are an attack. In fact, most of them are not an attack, right? But people who leave for secular reasons and who choose not to join another religious organization, especially a conservative religious organization, I think those are much more difficult issues to handle. You know, if someone starts talking about the Book of Abraham and Egyptology, that's a little different than talking about how, you know, there's only one God in the Bible. And, you know, I mean, those are a little different for people to encounter. I think that's probably
certainly makes sense. Yeah, that basically the evangelical is very simple, simply constructed, and yes. easy to disprove.
Absolutely, and it's really a matter of opinion, right? So, I'm choosing to believe an evangelical view instead of a Mormon view, and I'm gonna use my strict interpretation of the Bible to justify that. And so that's really just a matter of religious difference of opinion. When you start bringing in things like science and linguistics and all these other things, which really are not a matter of religious opinion. I mean, certainly the conclusions drawn are opinions ultimately, based on the available evidence. But it's a lot more difficult, I think, for people to engage. But you know, at the same time, I find that that most members of the church really just don't care one way or the other. They're happy. Like, I think of my family, you know, they're happy being Mormon, and yeah, they're aware that some people leave and that there is anti-Mormonism out there, whether it's secular or religious, and they're just kind of like, whatever, you know, I'm happy, I got my kids and I'm good. And so they, you know, why would they ever listen or question or whatever? But for those people who are in the church who don't fit and who do feel some sort of discomfort, you know, when they do hear these secular arguments, they may become intrigued and look at them, especially if they're more of an intellectual or a scientific type person, right? I mean, the evangelical arguments are not going to appeal to your typical college graduate who's, you know, is a, who rejects young earth creationism, for example. So, but these secular arguments will. And of course, there are a lot of different ways to deal with that. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think that may change as we move along, but I wonder how much it will change. I mean, you'll hear in the ex-Mormon community, people say how the internet is going to destroy the church and it's going to do this and that, and I'm not convinced. I mean, it the church is very flexible. If nothing, it's always been able to adjust to the times, and I think John Gee's recent talk on the Book of Abraham, I mean, that's, I think in years to come we'll look back at that as being a very significant talk on Abraham, where you know, he's not really stepping away from it, but he's definitely downplaying the Book of Abraham. And then, of course, the Church News organization picks that up and makes it very important, right? So we may or may not look back on this, but I tend to think we may look back on this and say, you know, this is the Church adjusting to the times, right? And just kind of being flexible. So. Again, I'm not convinced that the internet is going to be the destruction, quote unquote, of the church. The church is just going to change and become whatever it needs to be.
All right, Seth, any last thoughts?
You know, just in conclusion, I just reiterate that that the most important thing I learned from this study is that exiting the church is difficult, and I think for a lot of people it's the right thing for them to do. They do seem, you know, why stick with something and why force yourself to believe something that you don't necessarily believe and that doesn't kind of jive with who you are as a person. And I support that, and I think. But at the same time, I think that I think it's a tragedy that so many people are letting go of their Mormon heritage, because I think it's a very fascinating heritage. It's certainly a troubling heritage in certain respects, but it's fascinating and nonetheless. So I think that there's a lot that members of the church can do, and that those of us who maybe, you know, heterodox and heteroprax, can do to help people maintain that sense of Mormon heritage, if they want to. You know, if they don't want to, I think that's great too. But what I found is there's so many people who is such a painful experience leaving, and that they really wish they could have found a way to stay connected in at least some way with the church. I think there's a lot more we can do as members of the church to help people find that place, and far too often we are we're pushing people out because we're culturally demanding this orthodox position and especially orthoprax positions, and I think that's counterproductive ultimately. So I do hope that culturally speaking, as we move forward, there will be more acceptance of divergent views, and you know, if someone doesn't want to believe that the Book of Mormon is historical, that maybe they can say that in church and not be run out, you know, things like that. So that's the main message that I learned from these narratives, is that these are real, these are very painful experiences, and I think that we as people who are involved with the church should help people through this process as best we can.
Okay, great. Seth, you want to throw your blog URL out there?
So I blog at, it's just my name, sethpayne.com. I have different things about Mormonism and ethics and public policy up there. I also operate mormonstudies.net, and I'm transitioning that to mormonstudies.com. So my research can be found there. And of course, if anybody has any questions or comments for me, feedback, if they've read my paper, I'm very open to that. I can be reached at sethpayne@gmail.com, and I'd love to hear from people.
Great. And we'll put links to all those up, including the paper that you wrote that we were discussing this evening. Thanks again for participating with us. We invite everybody to look at the MormonExpression.com website to follow up on the discussion and see what else is going on there. Remember, you can call and leave a message for us at 801-906-6722 or you can email us your comments or audio for future podcasts at mail@mormonexpression.com. Our music is provided by Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com.